loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss the two new reports for the U.S. Senate that are being used to generate, whip up additional hysteria against Russia. We're going to look at what these reports actually say. And then we continue our weekly segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa. It's a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, there are only 5 days to go before a partial government shutdown, but the White House and congressional Democrats are digging in their heels. As members of Congress left Washington for the Christmas holiday, presidential senior advisor Stephen Miller said the administration will, quote, do anything that is necessary, unquote, to build a border wall. But Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the president is not going to get a wall in any form. Next, U.S. airstrikes over the weekend killed 62 purported members of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group in a remote area of southern Somalia. A spokesman for the Pentagon's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, said the strikes were carried out jointly with the Somali government and were designed to prevent future Shabaab attacks. But what's behind the stepped-up role of AFRICOM that these strikes reflect? Is the U.S. engaged in a major escalation of its drone war program? Then, a federal judge in Texas on Friday struck down the Affordable Care Act, ruling that because Congress changed the tax law associated with it, the entire system is no longer legal. The decision will be appealed immediately and will likely end up in the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, experts say that the decision will affect literally every American. And then President Trump on Friday named as acting chief of staff OMB Director Mick Mulvaney. Mulvaney also is director of the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Both of these latter positions make him susceptible to congressional subpoena. Why did Trump finally settle on Mulvaney, someone who already has two jobs, after an embarrassingly protracted search for a chief of staff? And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, President Trump publicly criticized Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell yet again today for the Fed's interest rate policy. Trump tweeted, quote, "It is incredible that with a very strong dollar and virtually no inflation, the outside world blowing up around us, Paris is burning and China way down, the Fed is even considering yet another interest rate hike. Take the victory!" Exclamation point. Interest rate hikes tend to slow down overall growth rates, undercutting Trump's narrative of a booming economy. The head of the Independent Election Commission of Afghanistan announced today that the country's presidential election will take place on April 20th. Results will be announced by June. This announcement comes as representatives of the Taliban and the United States met in the United Arab Emirates in the hopes of moving the peace process forward. Turkish President Erdogan said today that his army could launch a new offensive into northern Syria at any moment. He also claimed that he had spoken with Donald Trump, who allegedly gave him a green light for the operation. The aim of the offensive would be to remove the Kurdish YPG militia, a sworn enemy of the Turkish government, from the targeted area. The Saudi Foreign Ministry issued a statement today rejecting recent resolutions passed by the U.S. Senate. The ministry said, quote, "The kingdom categorically rejects any interference in its internal affairs, any and all accusations in any manner that disrespect its leadership," unquote. The Senate resolutions condemned the Saudi government for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and for the country's war on Yemen, which has been backed by the Pentagon. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to two new reports prepared for the Senate Intelligence Committee that assert that Russians working at the Internet Research Agency clearly sought to influence the 2016 election to the benefit of Trump and the Republican Party. The report adds that African Americans in particular were targeted to either not vote or to vote for third-party candidates. But are these reports just more of the same, and were these operations carried out with almost no money at all? I'm looking at a Washington Post headline, new report on Russian disinformation prepared for the Senate shows the operation scale and sweep. That sounds scary. We're going to talk about what it really says, though. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Daniel, Jim Kavanaugh, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, very dramatic headlines. It was in the Washington Post over the weekend, then the New York Times. The Post says, new report on Russian disinformation prepared for the Senate shows the operation scale and sweep. I want to talk about the scale and the sweep. I want to talk about who the authors of these reports actually are, and to find out whether it actually is the smoking gun that everyone has been waiting for and so far hasn't existed, showing that there was, in fact, a collusion between Russia and Trump, or that Russian intervention was of an impactful character on the 2016 election. Daniel Lazar, let's start with you. What do you think?
First of all, number one, I'm sure that some Russians somewhere were trying to influence the U.S. election. And Yevgeny Prigozhin was probably one of them.
Is he the owner of the internet research agency, the St. Petersburg Troll Farm IRA?
Yes, he is.
Go ahead.
Now, so there are just a tons of questions, and none of these reports, nothing that I've seen out of Washington addresses them in any way. I mean, one is, what is Prigozhin's relationship to Putin? Why are the sums that were spent so small? Why did they try to play both sides of the fence? Appealing to both liberals and conservatives. What was the actual impact of these ads? I mean, as far as I can tell, it was negligible. I guess that's really about it. But, you know, but this whole thing is strikes me as just completely unimpressive. And I see no evidence at all that any kind of significant Russian government campaign to influence the election. And that said, there's no doubt that the Kremlin would want to see Trump in office because its relations with Hillary Clinton were abysmal. So they were rooting for one side. Other governments are rooting for other sides. You know, but what does this all add up to? There's so many holes here. It just seems to be a big nothing burger, as Van Jones once said.
Before we go to Jim Kavanaugh, I want to play an audio clip because we're talking about the scale and the sweep of Russian interference in the 2016 election. There's no alleged anymore. It's just an assumed fact. It's an article of faith. Here's an audio clip. It's Congressman Jerome Nadler, Democrat from New York, asking Google CEO Sundar Pichai about the extent of the so-called Russian influence campaign using their network, using Google or Google Ads. Pichai was testifying last week in front of the House Judiciary Committee. John, when we hear the clip, I'm gonna just assume, as all of our listeners will assume and our guests, that Jerome Nadler had not done enough research, because if he'd known what the Google CEO was going to say, he might not have asked this question.
Yes.
Let's listen to it.
Does Google now know the full extent to which its online platforms were exploited by Russian actors in the election 2 years ago?
We have... You know, we undertook a very thorough investigation, and in 2016, we now know that there were two main ad accounts linked to Russia, which you know, advertised on Google for about $4,700 in advertising. We also found other limited...
Total of $4,700?
That's right.
Okay, $4,700. Jim Kavanaugh... They used $4,700 on Google to come at our democracy.
Yeah, and they were quite successful. My God. You know, you read these things. It's like getting stoned back in the old days and talking about whether Paul was dead, you know, and going through the Beatles songs trying to find the clues. Donald Trump, you know, the Russian, as Dan said, I have no doubt that people in Russia and maybe people close to the Russian government had favorites in the election, as many other people did. Happens all the time. Now, whether these ad campaigns were dispositive in the outcome of the election, can we just remember that Donald Trump lost the election by 3 million votes?
Yes.
The reason he's president is because of the Electoral College. That's the trick that put Donald Trump in the White House. Did Vladimir Putin go back in time and persuade the founding fathers to put an electoral college in the Constitution?
I think so. I think the answer is yes. I think the Kremlin made us have the Electoral College.
Exactly. So you nobody's talking about anything like that. These real issues that these troll farms were, you know, they say, oh my gosh, they said that they were kind of favored Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein and Black Lives Matter and then Blue Lives Matter and then Trump. So were they actually as troll farms following the trends? No. They were creating the trends on behalf of Putin. This is just silly. And there's another article today in Forbes, which is just these nicely colored concentric circles that show, I don't know what, but you know, that the Russians were in control of everything and Donald Trump was definitely in collusion with them. It's just, this has nothing to do with real politics. And it's kind of lunacy. And if the Russian government, I got to say, in 2010 or 2015, got together and said, let's figure out a program to elect Donald Trump as president, then I got to say, the Russian government is pretty stupid because I can't see them saying in 2015 even, oh, this is the guy we want to have as president. I mean, maybe they didn't like Hillary, but, you know, this isn't some grand narrative of Russia and Trump getting together. And now Trump was trying to make some money, and he's always trying to make some money, and he's a thief and a con man, and I had a high school student who invested with him and stole his money. I have a nephew who used to work for a contractor in New York. Their first rule was no work for Donald Trump, no Trump projects, they never pay. So the guy is a con man, and he's going to probably be unindicted, at least, or an undoubted co-conspirator on some financial scam. But this whole narrative, this huge, years-long effort for the Russian government and Vladimir Putin to elect Donald Trump is just silly. And none of these graphs or these projects, the computational propaganda project, proves any of it. They just say, look at all these Facebook ads.
That's the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. We're also joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. We listened to that audio clip of where Jerome Nadler asked the CEO of Google, can you tell us the full extent of Russian involvement on Google, on your platform? And he says, yes, after a thorough investigation, we've determined they spent $4,700 in Google ads. That's meaning the Internet Research Agency. Before we go further, because there's a lot here, I want to talk about how extreme this narrative is. Like, again, the Washington Post, the scale and the sweep of Russian interference now revealed. I mean, I want to talk about who the authors are of this report, these contractors. But before we do that, let's hear another audio clip. It's that great sage, Thomas Friedman, you know, the one who loves Mohammed bin Salman and said, yes, he was going to be the great reformer for Saudi Arabia. He's talking about what this Russian interference, this, I guess, $4,700 on Google alone, what it's like in terms of a historical perspective. Let's listen to sage columnist, author Thomas Friedman.
We have never taken seriously from the very beginning, Russia hacked our election. That was a 9/11 scale event. They attacked the core of our very democracy. That was a Pearl Harbor scale event.
Wow, Daniel, it was Pearl Harbor and September 11th all rolled into one, minus the thousands of deaths and things like that.
Right.
It's just beyond ludicrous. I mean, first of all, the question is, like, you know, the Russian actors purchased $4,700 worth of Google ads. What does that phrase Russian actor mean? I mean, is there any connection between IRA, Internet Research Associates agency, and Putin himself? All we know is that Putin, on a couple of occasions, dined in a restaurant owned by Yevgeny Prigozhin, the owner of the IRA. But what does that mean?
Well, now everybody in the Western media now calls him Putin's cook because Putin ate there. It's Pearl Harbor. It's September 11th. I mean, it's the worst things in the world, and it's Putin's cook.
It's top chef.
Top chef.
There's so many leaps of logic here. It's just astonishing. And there's this, you know, the level of hysteria is out of control. But we also know that the other countries do the same thing. There's a scandal in Britain right now, for example, by something called the Institute for Statecraft, is running something called the Integrity Initiative, where they're apparently trying to orchestrate propaganda against Russia in 15 European capitals. You know, this sounds, by the way, much more impressive than anything the Russians are doing. But you know, but they're all sides are now engaging in these concerted propaganda campaigns. And this one involving IRA strikes me as really piddling in comparison. People like Friedman are just insane.
The Washington Post, John Kiriakou.
Yes.
The headline from a year ago, a Russian firm spent $100,000 on Facebook ads. What we've been talking about right now are the $4,700 of IRA ads on Google. But the big headline before was about Facebook ads.
Right.
A Russian firm spent $100,000 on Facebook ads. Anyway, that was the Washington Post. Gareth Porter did an analysis of those $100,000 plus of Facebook ads. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, 6 or 7 weeks ago, Gareth Porter did an analysis of this for Consortium News. And what he found was absolutely fascinating. You only have to scratch just barely beneath the surface. And this is something that reporters for The Washington Post and The New York Times did not do. For example, I'm gonna read just a very short thing that that Gareth wrote in Consortium News. He's talking about Facebook's general counsel, Colin Stretch, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in October. And he says, quote, our best estimate is that approximately 126 million people may have been served by one of these IRA-generated stories at some time during the two-year period that is leading up to the 2016 election. So he's saying Stretch was expressing a theoretical possibility rather than an established accomplishment. Facebook was saying that it estimated 126 million Facebook members might have gotten at least one story from the IRA, not over the 10-week election period, but over 194 weeks during the years from 2015 through 2017. That figure in turn was based on the estimate that 29 million people might have gotten at least one story in their Facebook feed over that same period. Okay, but here's what it actually comes down to. The first problem with citing those figures as evidence of impact on the 2016 election is that Facebook did not claim that all or even most of the 80,000 IRA posts were election related. Okay. In fact, only 8.4% of those IRA posts were related to the election. That is, over the two-year period, 0.4%. 0.4%. So what Gareth is concluding is that for every one IRA-related election piece, there were 23,000 other news articles in the average Facebook user's newsfeed. So 23,000 to one. That is not influencing an election.
Jim Kavanaugh, let's talk about this, about the real numbers. And also, Donald Trump spent $90 million, not $4,700 on Google or not these $100,000 on Facebook ads, 56% of which, by the way, were after the November 2016 election. Trump spent $90 million, way more than the Clinton administration on social media. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, as you say, most of those ads, I think, were after the election. And as John pointed out, even the rest of the ads were not specifically necessarily targeted about the election. To the election. And let's not forget, I read the three of these articles this morning about the IRA. Well, I hate to use that term as an Irishman about the International Internet Research Agency. But you know, none of them mentioned the fact that the IRA showed up in court. The IRA came in with lawyers and came and said, all right, let's have a trial. And it's the government, it's the Mueller people who said, oh, wait a minute now, we gotta ask for a continuance. That's been going on for months.
Let's slow down and help the audience really get what that means. So the Mueller probe indicted the IRA as part of that indictment of 13 different entities who were indicted for interference in the U.S. election.
The fact of that indictment is what the media used to state as fact that the IRA was involved in it.
Right. So the indictment became, you know, proof, where an indictment is an assertion as of yet unproved. You have the right to be, you know, to be presumed not guilty until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But Mueller and the Mueller probe actually thought this would never be tested because these people live in Russia. They're not going to come here and contest the indictment. But in fact, they did. And it threw the Mueller team into a panic because that would mean on discovery that they would have the right to understand what's the foundational information that the government possesses that would lead to this indictment. So Mueller did not expect this to actually be a trial. He expected, as you're saying, a paper indictment and lots of news headlines. Go ahead.
Yep. So now, you know, but the fact is that these media accounts this morning in the Washington Times and in the Washington Post and the New York Times and in Forbes, all about the International Research Agency, but none of them mentioned the fact that the International Research Agency has shown up in court and asked to have this tried. So, you know, why just not mentioning that is itself something that's...
That's true. Why didn't they mention that?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's no way they wouldn't mention that if it were anything else but Russia. They were trying to promote this story in a way that's misleading. It's super... I mean, it's the definition of misleading. And, you know, then they go on about they used Muppets and they used Satan and Jesus. And again, and they say, oh, well, yeah, there are real, they were real. The article in the New York Times says, yes, there are real tensions, racial tensions in the United States. But the Russians were trying, they didn't invent them, but they're trying to exploit them. Well, someone might have been trying to exploit them for money. Someone might have been trying to exploit them for political effect. But why don't we spend more time talking about the real tensions that are there? And, you know, that's... Russia didn't invent those, as they say. And the Clinton campaign and the Sanders campaign and the Black Lives Matter were all happening in the United States. And it only makes sense for people who are trying to get an audience on Facebook to follow the trends. So it really doesn't make any difference how many ads. If the question is, who was doing it? What were they trying to do it for? And what difference did it make?
Daniel Azar, you know, I sent this around to a few people this morning. This was my favorite part of the New York Times article today about this one of the two reports. This is from an organization called New Knowledge. The Senate commissioned them to do this report. People should look at the New Knowledge website. It's like so thin, and I don't know what they are actually, but here's the New York Times. Listen to these words. The New Knowledge researchers discovered many examples of the Russian operators building an audience with one theme and then shifting to another, often more provocative set of messages. For instance, an Instagram account called @ArmyOfJesus first posted in January 2015 images of the Muppet Show, then shifted to The Simpsons, and by early 2016 became Jesus-focused. Multiple memes associated Jesus with Mr. Trump's campaign and Satan with Mrs. Clinton's. That's the favorite part. That's my favorite part of the article.
Just great.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, you know, it's just the IRA actually has an active website now, which I would urge your listeners to check out. It's called usareally.com. And just go there and see what they have. They have a bunch of stories with a vaguely anti-establishment bias, but they're innocuous. The whole thing will strike you as a kind of a low grade version of Al Jazeera or the BBC, and all these national outlets have their certain kind of bias, and USA really is a much more primitive version of this, but it's just so innocuous, it's so unimpressive, and how these people can be working themselves up to a lather about this conspiracy so immense, it just beggars the imagination.
You know, after Twitter and Facebook were chastened and Google for not doing their part in the witch hunt against Russia, Twitter announced that Sputnik is banned from taking out any more Twitter ads.
Yes.
Sputnik can't take out another ad on Twitter. Well, guess what? Sputnik has never asked to take out an ad on Twitter. We were banned from taking out an ad on a platform we never used. There was another thing that was also in the banning was RT, Russia Today TV. Guess what? Twitter, in the beginning of the 2016 election campaign, went to RT and offered RT a package to enhance RT's coverage of the 2016 election campaign. Twitter came to RT, not the other way around, and RT actually... said no to the offer because it was too expensive. Twitter was willing to work with and have Twitter employees work with RT to expand their reach in the 2016 campaign, and it was RT that said no. So let's go back to the beginning. Donald Trump lost the election by 3.5 million votes, but he won some battleground states in the Electoral College, And Hillary Clinton could have considered actually visiting, say, the state of Wisconsin once during the 2016 campaign, but she chose not to. Why? Because it was a Democratic stronghold? No. I mean, Governor Walker, the Republican, had won. I mean, why not contest there? And then the other thing, Jim, is that Trump spent $90 million on social media. Hillary Clinton spent all of her money on TV ads. Mm-hmm. And social media, as it turns out, is more powerful, but it wasn't the IRA money. It was Donald Trump's social media. And Wired has written numerous times, but very significant articles on how effective Trump's social media efforts actually were. Go ahead.
This is exactly, I mean, it's the amount of money that was spent. And again, you know, the idea that the Russian government was sitting around for years trying to plot this out and did such a terrible job of it and put someone in power who in the end isn't really doing anything for Russia except increasing sanctions and sending arms to Ukraine. It's just silly. But the point of these articles is, and in the Times article, I'm going to read something from this because it's important. While right-wing pages promoted Mr. Trump's candidacy, the left-wing pages scorned Mrs. Clinton while promoting Senator Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein. The voter suppression effort was focused particularly on Sanders supporters and African Americans, urging them to shun Mrs. Clinton in the general election and either vote for Ms. Stein or stay home. So the implication is that the Stein and Sanders campaigns and all of the left dissidents were really being manipulated by Russia. And that's the only reason that was out there. You know, again, this was happening because people in the United States didn't like Hillary Clinton, and people who normally voted for her didn't like her. So that's why Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein had traction. And anybody who was trying to get an audience for whatever reason was going to follow that. They didn't create it. They were following it. But it's being now presented as a way which is trying to shame Jill Stein and Bernie Sanders supporters for being part of a Russian operation.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. I just want to point out, too, the point that Jim is making. The Trump administration has been harder on Russia than the Obama administration.
Without a doubt.
Today in the Wall Street Journal, Richard Grenell, Trump's ambassador to Germany, who might have been his chief of staff if he had wanted the job, he wrote an editorial that said, Germans, take a stand against Nord Stream 2. The pipeline project would aggravate dependence on Russia, harming European states. Russia's recent aggression in the Sea of Azov reminds us the need for vigilance against Vladimir Putin's malign activities. That's Donald Trump's ambassador to Germany. That's the real position of the Trump administration. Anyway, we are out of time. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
As always, good to be back.
Thank you. Thank you for joining. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the Department of Homeland Security and specifically Customs and Border Protection. The report came out last week that found a couple of disturbing things. First of all, Customs and Border Protection are significantly increasing the number of electronic device searches on the border and at ports of entry that they are doing. This number has significantly gone up. Also concerning about this report is that it says that they don't have a good control over what the officers are doing with this data. So a few things to note. First of all, Customs and Border Protection considers the border to be a 100-mile area inland from the actual physical borders or imaginary borders, however you want to look at it, of the United States. That's about 2/3 of the U.S. population that's covered, and they can get on a bus and or you know be at an airport and actually you know demand your device. They are permitted to actually search your devices if it's been referred for a secondary inspection. They can look through your cell phones, your tablet, your computer, your USB drives, but there are very few regulations in place over what what happens with the data after they have searched. If they've made a backup copy of it, they're supposed to get rid of it, but it has been shown, and actually they have gone to court over this, that they haven't been deleting the data. A woman actually had to go to court to sue Customs and Border Protection after they took her phone in February and made copies of the data on it. And she won that case in October on Fourth Amendment grounds. And the court forced CBP to delete that data, right? But they still haven't improved their practices. They still haven't improved their policies. In fact, what the report says, there were USB thumb drives just sitting around in offices at various CBP offices. They hadn't been deleted. They could have been just picked up and stolen, and somebody could have walked out with them.
Yeah, Chris Garaffa is our guest. This is an important issue because the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects Americans purportedly from random and arbitrary stops and seizures by the government. According to the government, though, these constitutional protections known as the Fourth Amendment don't exist if you're within 100 miles of a port of entry for immigration. Now, that means, and as Chris mentioned, was it 3 out of 4 or 2 out of 3 people living in the country live within that 100-mile border, something like that?
2 out of 3. It's practically the entire, all of New England and the Mid-Atlantic region, including the District of Columbia.
And just to get an understanding of what this actually means, the government, the police, they do not have the right to search you and seize your property. They do not have that right. But they make the point that this doesn't apply to the Border Patrol if it's within 100 miles, where 2/3 of all of us live.
And that's why you have the Border Patrol now getting on Greyhound buses 100 miles inland in Florida, in Georgia, all different kinds of places, and demanding to see people's papers.
Yeah, so they walk down the bus, which is literally what's happening, and they look at somebody. They look at, say, you, John, and they think, oh, you're not Latino. Maybe you're Greek, which, of course, you are ethnically from in terms of your family lineage. But we're not going to ask him for his information.
Yep.
But the guy sitting next to you looks like maybe he is from the Dominican Republic or Guatemala. So they have the right to ask.
That's the thing. You can't say no.
You can't say no. And the whole point of the Fourth Amendment prohibits the government without a probable cause for having conducted, being involved in criminal conduct, the government doesn't have the right to stop you and search you and seize you.
Yes.
Except here they do.
That's right.
And people have to recognize this as a fundamental attack on everyone's liberties. Of course, it's racist. It's against Latinos. It's against other non-white immigrant populations. But it's an assault on everyone's rights.
That's absolutely the case, and we should point out that the woman in the case that I mentioned earlier was a Muslim woman. This is the woman whose CBP took her phone in February. They made copies of it, and she sued and won. And it's important to note she won on Fourth Amendment grounds.
All right, let's go on to the next story.
This one is very close to my heart. It involves a man named Aaron Swartz. He was a privacy activist. He was a researcher. The FBI targeted him starting, about a decade ago. And unfortunately, because of the FBI harassment and the case against him, he took his own life in January of 2013. They basically charged him with downloading information off of a website.
Literally, that's what he did. Yes.
Literally off of a website. Yes. JSTOR it's basically a website that hosts academic journals, right? And so he found a way to download a lot of stuff. He had also downloaded things from PACER, which is a Justice Department library. So he had been harassed for that. But a report came out in Gizmodo early last week, basically showing that the FBI had information on Aaron Swartz in 2007 because of a separate investigation into Al-Qaeda. Now, he had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, but they got information. He was at the University of Pittsburgh doing, technical, it was computer science. And the NSA and the FBI had sucked up a bunch of emails as part of this investigation into Al-Qaeda from the University of Pittsburgh. What this shows is that some of Aaron Swartz's emails were in this file that were picked up. This is an American citizen. A student at a university whose emails were picked up in this international investigation targeting Al-Qaeda. Now, we were always told, right, that the NSA doesn't spy on American citizens. It doesn't spy on communications in the U.S. But what they always forget to mention was that if there was communication between somebody in the U.S. and somebody outside of the U.S., that was fair game to them. And that was the public discussion they had, and that was the public explanation. But what they always promoted was this idea that if you're an American citizen, your information is not going to be sucked up in these massive data dragnets. And this is another example of showing how that is just absolutely not true. And also the sharing of information between the NSA and the FBI. The NSA is not supposed to spy on Americans legally. Of course, we know it does. And they're sharing data with other law enforcement agencies, including the FBI.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. Chris, let's keep. We have so many stories to cover. Let's go on to the next one.
Brian and John, do you remember that big story about Supermicro and the Chinese army planting chips on Supermicro hardware? Well, it turns out it was completely, completely fake. It was a cover of Bloomberg. It was covered everywhere. I mean, and everyone involved came out and said this is not true. Supermicro said it's not true. The Chinese government said it's not true. Apple and other customers of Supermicro, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security immediately came out and said it wasn't true, which was significant because you'd think that they'd want to buy into this whole, the anti-China campaign. But this was so outrageous that they couldn't even use it as propaganda, right? So there was a long third-party investigation done, a company hired by Supermicro, and they say they found no malicious hardware. They worked not just with Supermicro and their supply chain, but also with customers. They went in and looked at, the hardware that was installed at their customer sites, at Apple, at Google, at all these other companies, and there was absolutely nothing there. Unfortunately, I don't think Bloomberg is going to publish a retraction. I don't think We Messed Up is going to be their next cover, but it certainly should be.
Yeah, this is just yet another reminder that we have to take everything we read with a grain of salt, and it doesn't matter if it's in a newspaper of record like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times. There is so much fake news out there that it's a wonder any of us know anything that's going on.
Yeah, this story from Bloomberg, and we have talked about it in the past, but it's just worth repeating that it was so outrageous that no one could back it up. But Bloomberg has really stuck its heels in the dirt and is saying, well, it's still true. And now they've actually gone and just they're silent about it. They won't talk about it.
All right. Chris Garaffa is our guest. Let's keep moving. Chris, what's the next story?
The next one involves, of all things, it's Facebook. Another Facebook data breach. Facebook last week on the 14th put out a note on its developer news website saying that there was what they call a bug in their photo API. An API is just a system that other developers can use to tap into Facebook and get information, and that's how they make Facebook apps. But there was a bug in Facebook they released it last week. They released the information last week. It was about 12 days in September, from the 13th to the 25th, where apps that you have given access to your public photos could actually have gotten access to your more private photos that are on Facebook. There's a few things about this that are really concerning. I mean, bugs in software happen, but at a size like Facebook, they should be testing this kind of thing, and they should have been aware of it before it happened. This affects 6.8 million users and up to 1,500 apps by over 850 developers. Facebook says, we're sorry this happened. That's the extent of their apology. We're sorry this happened. A couple scary things about this. One is that early next week, we will be rolling out tools for app developers that will allow them to determine which people using their app might be impacted by this bug. So these app developers might have photos that you didn't want them to have, and they're going to tell you whose photos they have. They're going to tell the app developer whose photos they have that the users didn't want the developers to have. That seems like a really bad idea. The second thing is to note here is they're very upfront about this. If you start to upload a photo to Facebook, or you upload something and delete it, or you even just put it in a post and then cancel that post, they still have a copy of that photo. Whether or not you actually posted it, if you just put it into the Facebook little post thing and then hit cancel, they still have a copy of that photo. They don't delete it.
I don't think anybody knew that. I certainly didn't.
You know, Chris, I want to ask you about Facebook on another topic. Is Facebook downgrading people who have been targeted for one reason or another? Are they downgrading, like, how many people see your posts, how many people thus will like or share your information?
They have very complicated algorithms, and people have been trying to figure out how they work. Facebook is constantly changing and adjusting them. So Facebook will see who interacts with you on Facebook, you know, who interacts with you, who of your friends, if you have a personal account, interacts, who's posting similar things to what you're posting, and really creates this bubble. If you have a public page, like this show does, then they certainly do limit your audience based on not only that, but also they want you to buy ads. Of course, we can't buy an ad for this show. That's going to be restricted. But for public pages, they want you to buy ads, and they want you to give them money to promote to an audience. It's effectively they do create a bubble based on your friends' interests, who you're interacting with, and who's interacting with you on what type of post. I've also seen very recently and frequently that people get blocked for posting too frequently, but it's only about certain types of content. If they're posting links.
Right.
Right. So people, I mean, I have friends on Facebook who post personal updates every 20 minutes, and they don't get blocked, and they certainly shouldn't. But people who post links to news stories, maybe from RT, from Sputnik, from other sites, you're being spammy. You're spamming your friends. We're going to block you for 12 hours, and then we're going to block you for 24, and then up to 7 days. And so Facebook, yes, it absolutely is targeting what people are posting and what audience is able to see it.
I was wondering about that, Chris, partly because of my own experience in the past week, and I was trying to understand it. Like, I was posting fairly regularly on Facebook. I have, 4,000 friends or a little bit more than that. And then I posted something about, a week ago about, it was from the Frank Church hearings, the CIA's heart attack gun. They can make your murder look natural.
Mm-hmm.
You know about this?
Oh, sure.
The post was, in 1975, this formerly secret CIA weapon was declassified. The information about this weapon comes from U.S. Senate testimony in 1975 relating to rogue activities of the CIA. The video shows actual congressional testimony explaining how the heart attack gun works. The heart attack gun shoots a small poison dart that is made of ice. The poison causes a heart attack. Then the dart melts and the poison denatures, so there is nothing that shows up in the autopsy. John Kiriakou, you know about this.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is well known.
Yeah, so I posted that, and like 142 people liked it, 223 people shared it, 24 comments, a lot of activity. And since then, every post I've made has gotten zero likes, zero comments, zero shares.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have 4,000 friends, and I'm politically active, and I'm engaged. And right before that, I had posted something about Palestinian protesters. So this, I've never experienced this since I've been on Facebook for the last couple of years, where no comments, no likes, no shares. You would think there'd be one. And I've posted some stuff with very poignant pictures, graphics, things that, you know, people wouldn't normally share. So my question is, Chris, is there something that people who are politically active, I'm not trying to make people paranoid, but who are politically active should be aware of? Because we see that Facebook has shut down a lot of accounts of people, especially, say, if they were pro-Palestinian or pro-BDS. Anyway, let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, certainly. Brian, I'm looking at your profile right now, and I don't see any posts since that one you mentioned, actually. So that's very concerning to me.
Wow.
I'm actually very concerned about this. You do have many, many friends. You have people who follow you because of your work in the anti-war movement and this show and many others. And if it's true, and we need to look at this, if it's true that Facebook is silencing you, that's a major issue.
I don't want to make that argument at the moment because we do have to investigate it. I was just curious about it because I was noticing it for the last days.
Well, let me add something to that, too. I have a good friend who's an Academy Award nominated, Emmy Award nominated documentary filmmaker. He's in the same predicament that you are, in that he will put something on Facebook and get 500 likes and 200 shares, etc. Every time he posts something related to Standing Rock, every single time he posts something related to Standing Rock, he gets no likes, no shares, no nothing. Well, last week he posted asking about it, saying, hey, here's the situation. I normally get all these hundreds of likes. I posted this thing about Standing Rock. I didn't get anything. What's up? And I responded immediately. I read everything that you post, and I never saw anything about Standing Rock. And then another 100-something people said the same thing. And as Chris says, it's this complicated algorithm. I think that they don't want us to see what they deem to be controversial political issues, especially if they're coming from the left.
Absolutely. Yeah, and again, I don't want to make any accusations either without having looked into this, but it is something that should be looked into.
Well, we will. We'll try to understand it. Again, we're not trying to be alarmist or anything like that, but, you know, it'll be curious as we investigate. We'll report to our audience.
And if you don't mind, I'd like to go on to another sort of Big Brother type of story, and this is related to Google and the fact that Google personalizes search results even when you're not signed into Google. So how does it know, Chris?
Well, so a little background here. If you're signed into Google and you're doing searches, it uses not just what you're searching for, but what you've searched for in the past on your account to kind of specialize your search results, which could be a good thing if you're searching for kind of a generic term, but in a specific domain related to a specific subject. It kind of learns what you're looking for. This is great for me when I do, you know, programming, when I used to use Google. But it turns out that they also track you and personalize your results when you're not signed in. So even if you're not signed in, there are still many different signals that they can use. The device that you're on, other sites that you have visited, what you're signed into in other sites, and all of those things, and they still personalize it for you. Now, if you're doing, you know, technical research or, you know, academic research, that's fine. If you're looking for news, though, that tends to create, and again, it's this idea of a bubble. That you can't break out of effectively because it's a constant feedback loop that it's showing you what it thinks you want to see combined with what it wants you to see. And then it uses those signals to say, well, you looked at this. You looked at this article from this source, which might be a liberal source, a conservative source, or, you know, whatever it is that is being promoted. And then it uses that to say, well, this is the kind of source you want to see. And it creates this bubble that creates a significant issue for getting alternative news sources out there.
It's very strange and it's very disappointing, frankly. Moving on, because we have so much to get through. Equifax. We've spoken about Equifax a number of times on this show. We've spoken about hacks of data and the misuse of corporate data. Tell us about Equifax and this latest breach.
Well, this is going back over a year now. Equifax announced in September 2017 there was a breach that ultimately affected nearly half of the U.S. population and over 50% of American adults. Equifax, of course, being a credit rating agency, one of these private companies that controls so much of our financial lives, right? You can't get a car loan, you can't even rent an apartment, even get a job sometimes without having a decent credit score. And they leaked so much information in this hack. So there was the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reform last week finally put out a report after investigating this. And it basically says that the breach was entirely preventable. That is their language, entirely preventable.
Somebody wasn't doing his job.
Yeah, they didn't do their job at Equifax. They explain the technical issues. There was a software vulnerability that had been disclosed in some software that Equifax was using, but Equifax hadn't tested and run the update to patch that vulnerability. They knew about it. They had met, actually had meetings. Their vulnerability management team had meetings about this vulnerability. They knew it, and they hadn't patched it yet. And it was 2 months before this vulnerability in the Apache Struts web software was disclosed. And that was in March 2017. It was 2 months after that the attack began on Equifax. That was May 2017. So they had 2 months, in fact, to research this, to update this software and to test it, and they just didn't do it. Now, this is a very detailed, it's about 100-page document from this congressional committee. It ends with 7 recommendations. None of them call for executives at Equifax to be fined or go to jail. Some of the other ones, they're fine. You know, review the FTC oversight, you know, empower consumers through transparency. There's some good language in there, but of course, there's nothing binding. There's nothing, you know, there are no commitments in here to anything. But I don't see anywhere where anyone actually gets punished for this breach. And that's really upsetting, honestly.
Chris, when something like that is detected, when there's a hole in this security that's detected, how long does it actually take to fix it? Like physically to get into the system and to fix it?
You know, once a vulnerability is released, you know, released to the wild, and basically that usually happens when the software developer says, "Hey, there was this issue. Go update your software to our new version."
Yeah.
A big company like Equifax, you're going to want to test that. You're going to want to spend days or maybe even weeks testing it to make sure it's not going to break anything else, because it would be bad also if it, you know, broke your systems or your website. But it does not take, generally, it does not take 2 months. It does not take 6 months to do that, especially something as significant and important as what this software component was for them. It was public facing. It was out on the internet.
Let's move on and talk about Taylor Swift, who we've never talked about Taylor Swift on our technology segment, John,
or any other segment,
or any other segment. But Chris, you want to talk about this? What is it?
Well, yeah, I got a lot of heat here from friends on social media for talking about this. I admit I'm a Taylor Swift fan. I have never seen her in concert, but if I had seen her in concert, then I probably would have been, like many other people, caught on a facial recognition camera. It's actually a very complicated subject. Taylor Swift says, or her PR team says, they're using this to identify stalkers. And this is certainly an issue. Taylor Swift, as a performer, as a woman, has to deal with these issues of stalkers and creepy folks all the time, right? Many, many women, especially in the public sphere, have to deal with that. This private company, though, has set up facial recognition cameras to track people at her concerts and at other events. And they say, we don't know where the data is being stored. We don't know what's going on with this data. So that's the concerning thing. I fully support people's rights to, you know, be aware of you know, stalkers and dealing with those issues, especially when we know that oftentimes law enforcement doesn't do anything until something awful has happened, which is, you know, needs to be addressed. But the private company, the Oakview Group, that is doing this, there's no transparency here. There's no information about how long they're storing the data, what databases they're comparing it to, and where else it's being used. So is Madison Square Garden, for example, going to use this at other concerts as well? Or are they just setting this up?
I want to read from the New York Times. When Taylor Swift played the Rose Bowl in May, a kiosk was set up for adoring fans to view videos of her, but there may have been more to that screen than meets the eye. According to an interview in Rolling Stone, the kiosk took photos of people looking at the videos. The images were then sent back to a command post in Nashville, where they were cross-referenced using facial recognition technology with a database of people who had been identified as potential stalkers of the pop star. The use of facial recognition was revealed by Mike Downing, the chief security officer of Oakview Group, that's who Chris just mentioned, an entertainment company, who told Rolling Stone that he observed the technology firsthand as a guest of the company that designed the kiosks. Everybody who went by would stop and stare at it, and the software would start working.
Mm-hmm.
So outside of the validity of Taylor Swift's own security, which as Chris has said, is real, no denying that. But aside from that, this speaks to a bigger issue of how facial recognition will be used by corporations, because these are corporate events.
Mm-hmm.
How it will be used by the police, how it will be used by governments. I mean, this is a big deal. And again, outside of the article in the New York Times, there's no real public debate about whether this is a good idea. Because, of course, you can always make the argument for security. I mean, if you make the argument of security, you could make the argument in a way that no one should be allowed to do anything that's of a defiant character, say, to government policy. If you want to make the argument that if you create human beings who are nothing other than automatons, that they're robots, yeah, you can make that argument for security, but that's not the kind of society people want to live in.
I agree with you. It's a very complicated issue. There's a lot that needs to be addressed here and how to properly use technology, but not to use it for oppression. Absolutely.
Chris Garoff is our guest. Chris, we have 1 minute left. And of course, that means you're going to give us the technology tip for the week. What is it?
Well, the holidays are coming up next week. So a couple really quick holiday gift ideas, not expensive at all. One, just spread the word about being secure online. Go through our past tech tips. Second, if you get a lot of those robot calls, I subscribe to this service. I'm not otherwise affiliated with them. NoMoRobo, NoMoRobo. It's a couple bucks a month, and it prevents those awful robocalls from coming into your phone and harassing you. I think it's a great gift. It's not expensive. Another gift is set up LastPass for your friends and family. That's free. Just takes a little bit of time. Set up LastPass and get them in the habit of using secure passwords and not giving them out. There's a lot of things that you can do that don't require a lot of money that can be very simple to help out your friends, your family, your loved ones to be a little more secure, especially over the holidays.
All right. That was Chris Garoffa. Chris is our weekly guest in this segment called Technology Rules, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.